Hello, and welcome to The Lancet Oncology in Conversation With. I'm the deputy editor, Allie Landman, and today we have a special podcast dedicated to our latest commission, Global Cancer Surgery, Pragmatic Solutions to Improve Cancer Surgery Outcomes Worldwide. This report follows on from our previous commission on global cancer surgery, published in 2015, and answers a call for additional guidance on how to reach the goals of the first cancer surgery commission. Nearly 80% of patients with solid tumors will need surgery during the course of their disease. However, progress in improving global cancer surgery access, delivery, and care is too slow to meet demand. Building upon recommendations from the 2015 commission, this new commission report aims to provide a pragmatic roadmap for decision makers to reduce inequities and promote safe, timely, and affordable cancer surgery for every patient. To discuss the outcomes and implications of this commission for cancer surgery worldwide, I have with me lead author and chair of the commission, Dr. Chandra Aray, professor of surgical oncology and global health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska, in the U.S. Chandra, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Ali, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here.
Let's begin with having you give us a sense of the backdrop of the commission. What was established in the 2015 Commission on Global Cancer Surgery, and what challenges remain 8 years on? Despite being a central pillar of cancer care, why has cancer surgery remained undervalued for so long?
So just to give the backdrop to this and the previous commission, as we know, cancer is the second leading cause of death worldwide. The global cancer burden is expected to rise significantly over the next couple of decades, such as the number of new cancer cases is going to increase from about 19 million in 2020 to about 30 million in 2040. Now, cancer surgery is one of the key pillars in the multidisciplinary cancer care pathway. Nearly 80% of all patients with solid tumors will require surgical intervention at least once, and some or many will require surgical intervention more than once. And what is even more important is cancer surgery is required across the entire spectrum of cancer care continuum, going from screening, prevention, treatment, reconstruction, palliation, and rehabilitation. Unfortunately, about 75% or more of patients with cancer that require surgical intervention do not have access to safe, timely, or affordable cancer surgery. What's even more distressing is that the vast majority of these patients are in the LMICs, or low-resource parts of the world. Now, there are many factors that contribute to these inequities, but some of them include that there's a failure to acknowledge the importance of the role of cancer surgery, not just by people on this side, but including patients. So one example in Brazil, I've heard my colleagues say patients have a colectomy, and after the surgery, the first thing they ask the surgeon is, when does the cancer treatment start? So that lack of understanding of the value is ubiquitous. And then the next one is the upfront investments in cancer surgery are quite high. So most people that control the purse strings hesitate to invest. In their short-term vision, they forget the long-term benefits of the investments in cancer surgery because these benefits tend to be durable. So to address all of this, the first Lancet Oncology Commission was published, and it shone a light on all these inequities, and it also proposed some initiatives to address these inequities in cancer surgery access on the global stage. Now, 8 years later, some things have changed, such as more countries have national cancer control plans. More countries have NSOAPs, that's national surgical obstetric anesthesiology plans. For example, if you go to individual cancer sites, breast cancer, there's more being done in breast health global initiatives. Having said that, gross inequities still persist. Cancer surgery may not be an afterthought, but it's still marginalized. In those same increased NCCPs and NSOAPs, you don't see as much of a focus on cancer surgery. And what doesn't help in the last 3 to 4 years is major catastrophic events such as the pandemic, ongoing conflicts in different parts of the world. The first thing that gets disrupted during this catastrophic event is investment and resource-heavy surgical care pathways. So to help with the ongoing efforts and to build on the momentum from the first commission, the second commission was published. And the main purpose of the second commission is to create a roadmap of pragmatic, reality-grounded solutions and actions that can apply to every part of the world in a resource-stratified way. More so, we'd like to call them ground charts rather than moonshots.
That sounds great. So let's move directly on to the commission then, which describes 9 domains of cancer surgery within which are provided global solutions to improve surgical care for patients. So I'd like to do a bit of a deep dive into 2 areas that I believe are of particular interest for our audience: the importance of a well-trained and multidisciplinary workforce, which is covered in domains 4, 7, and 9, and the role of new technology, which is covered in domain 3. So the commission discusses workforce challenges, including an insufficient number of trained cancer surgeons and workers in allied disciplines, such as anesthesiology, pathology, and nursing, as well as a paucity of education and training opportunities. These workforce challenges can lead to fragmented, incomplete, and low-quality care. Can you tell us more about the consequences of this situation on surgical care and the solutions that the commission identified?
So this is an important part. So while this commission focuses on cancer surgery, it actually focuses on the entire continuum of cancer care. Now, cancer care has always been a poster child for team-based care. Long before team-based care came into existence, we were providing cancer care in a multidisciplinary format, because without that, you cannot provide effective cancer care. So if you look at the cancer care pathway, there are many key pillars and players going from medical oncology, radiation oncology, surgical oncology, anesthesiology, radiation, pain palliative care, nursing, theater staff, oncology navigators, and so on. Each one of them is absolutely essential if you correctly want to say that you're providing effective cancer care. So for example, it doesn't do much good if you can provide effective systemic therapy, but after that you can't remove the colon or the lump in the breast, or vice versa. It doesn't do much good if you do a lumpectomy or colectomy and the patient needs systemic therapy and you can't provide that either for lack of the drugs or lack of trained oncologists. So you can notice that every entity or pillar in this cancer care continuum is essential. Now, what's sad is that unfortunately we have a shortage of all these professionals. Not just surgical oncologists, we have a shortage of medical, radiation. You can just go through the entire list and there's a shortage of everyone. What's even more scary is that there's a shortage now with the current cancer burden, and we cannot scale up fast enough to keep up with the pace of the rising cancer burden. So for example, in many parts of the world, there are no fully trained medical oncologists. Until a few years ago, I've been to some countries where surgeons were still giving systemic therapy, and some parts of the world they still do. And in some parts, radiation oncologists give systemic therapy. And in some parts of the world that I've been to, they're part-time medical oncologists that cover many hospitals and are not in one hospital every day of the week. One other thing that always gets ignored is the lack of pain physicians. You know, cancer in itself is an awful diagnosis, and then you have this pain. You don't need to have surgery to have cancer-related pain. So you don't have pain control either due to lack of drugs or lack of fully trained physicians. And then you see these patients are not only suffering from the diagnosis of cancer, and then they're suffering from pain related to the cancer. So the commission provides some solutions to address this in the fourth domain. And in the interest of time, I'll just cover a few of those. Some of these can be The shortages can be addressed through technological solutions, such as you can have virtual platforms where you can train people from a distance, not from one country to another, within the same country. You can train people so that if you're in an urban area in a country with low resources, using these virtual platforms, you can train people to provide care closer to home. Then care pathway solutions, such as, you know, you need to have good infrastructure. It doesn't do much good to have a radiation oncologist if you don't have the equipment. Or if you have the equipment, you have it in an urban center when 60% of the population lives in rural areas. And then multi-sectoral collaborations, you know, global bodies such as WHO, United Nations, and professional, not just surgical, but professional oncologic societies can play a major role in upscaling the workforce through twinning programs or providing short-term observerships and so on. So while the commission may have a focus on cancer surgery, if you don't address the shortage in workforce of every person that's involved in the cancer care pathway, we're not going to be able to provide effective cancer care.
Thank you. So now we'll turn to technology, which can be an important driver of quality, safety, and outcomes in cancer surgery. Yet often new technologies are costly, they can be disruptive, and issues exist related to dissemination of and training for new technologies, which means that only a minority of patients might have access to the newest treatments. Can you tell us about the Commission's recommendations on implementing new technology into cancer surgical care and how the Commission considered cost and cost-benefit when assessing the role of technology in cancer surgery?
So first, I want to give a background to this. First and foremost, advancing science and the development of new technologies is absolutely essential to improving cancer care. You need new technologies, new advances, because they tend to be important drivers in improving the quality of care. So, for example, with new technology, you can perform the same procedure more effectively with reduced morbidity and mortality. I'll give you one example of prostatectomy. I trained at a time when most of these were done by the open procedures, time-tested, very successful, but it's a major operation with major morbidity and a low risk of mortality. Then laparoscopy came by, which reduced the pain and morbidity, but it was a steep learning curve that it didn't lead to quick adoption. Then the robot came by. That learning curve was a lot less, to the point now that almost 85% of the prostatectomies in America are done by the robotic approach. Patients go home sooner and their equivalent oncologic outcomes. Now, the other side is for technology to be effective, it has to be imbued in the principles of creative destruction or disruptive innovation. Now, for a technology to be durable and effective, they all tend to be quite expensive in development and production. And all of this will add to the cost of the care for the end user. The other thing to keep in mind is in the early phases of introduction of new technologies, because they tend to be expensive, they're out of reach of most of the people across the world. And the other thing it does is when new technologies come, we tend to divert, fairly or unfairly, a larger proportion of resources to these new technologies. As a result, what happens is a handful or a few patients will have access to the sophisticated new technology with maybe less pain and other better outcomes, while the majority may not have access to any type of. But having said that, every new technology in the current that is prohibitively expensive and available to only a few will at some stage in the future lead to downstream cascading benefits to many or most of the patients at an affordable cost. The charm is finding that balance and the right time on the inflection curve of adoption. Because what happens is as patents run out, newer low-cost versions come out, and more surgeons become more facile with using this, we can offer what used to be a brand new technology sometime 2 to 3 years ago to every patient. So having said that, we came out with some solutions in this commission, and some of those I'll just highlight here. The first one is using the IDEAL framework, which is a time-tested framework that if there's a new technology, put it through the grid of IDEAL framework. If it passes it, use it. If not, maybe think twice. Now, you can develop low-cost versions of the same technology. For example, we all have smartphones, but most of us use only 10 to 15% of what we have on the smartphone. So does every technology need to be that expensive with all the features that we barely use? Probably not. So you can develop low-cost versions of that as well. The next and maybe the most important thing is real-time assessment of the benefits. You bring in a new technology, it's a toy and a fad, then you need to do assessment to validate its benefit. If it passes that test, continue using it. If not, maybe think twice. The other thing we need to keep in mind is if you bring in a new technology, so you bring in a robot, but you don't have the operating room infrastructure or trained surgeons to do it, $2.2 to $2.4 million worth of investment did not translate to good outcomes for patients. The last two things you want to keep in mind is as much as possible, we should try to see that technology benefits as many or all the patients that actually need it. And probably the last one, we need to make sure that care dictates where technology is used, not the other way around. The best example is when laparoscopy came in, there were situations where we said, well, I have a new tool here. Where's my patient? We don't want that. What we want is I have the patient here with the disease. What is the best tool that is available for me to provide safe care at the most affordable cost?
Thank you. Some important points there. So of unique value to the Commission is the section on recommendations to improve cancer surgery in the six WHO regions. This exhaustive section identified many common solutions that could be successful in many regions, but it also goes into detail regarding region and context-specific challenges and opportunities. Given the specific needs in different regions, do you think there is value in cross-regional collaboration and knowledge sharing? How do you see global efforts interacting with these regional actions to improve cancer surgical care?
I think there's absolutely that answer is yes. There are benefits. This Lancet Oncology Commission is one example. This is a cross-collaboration between about 50 leaders and experts from literally every corner of the world. So you're right. That is a very valuable part of the commission because we know there are extremely wide variations in everything about cancer across different parts of the world, starting with the types of tumors, the biology of the same tumor, and then cancer care pathways, the educational platforms, the healthcare environment. And what we need to keep in mind is we not only find differences between different countries, but sometimes different regions of the same country in terms of variation. So for example, breast cancer, it tends to affect women in their 60s or around that age in the high-income country part of the world. You go to the LMICs, it's much earlier, 40 to 50s. So there are differences there. Similarly, if you look at gallbladder cancer, it's a rare cancer in high-income countries. But we have no idea, but there are some factors. But it's much higher in some parts of Latin America and the northern part of India. Any reason? Probably, but we don't know exactly why that happens. Along the same lines, the training pathways to train cancer surgeons is so widely variable. You have some parts of the world where you have structured training pathways with surgical oncology fellowships that train highly specialized cancer surgeons, or who we would like to call complexivists, that sometimes focus on one organ system. And then you have the majority of the world where the training systems are not as structured. Many parts of the world don't even have surgical oncology fellowships, where most of the times they train general surgeons, or who we call generalists, that have to take care of a wide variety and spectrum of cancers. And as a result, research has shown that, in fact, there isn't even a uniform definition of who a cancer surgeon or surgical oncologist is, leave alone coming to a uniform process for certifying them. So while there are all these differences, there are many benefits that we get from this. So for example, if you have a multinational tumor board and you're discussing gallbladder cancer, experts from countries where there's high incidence can provide valuable input to people that deal with this in low incidence countries. And in the same way, there are several other things that are done well, maybe in the high income countries, such as cancer registries, setting them up, hospital wide registries, population based registries. Now, although more and more are coming up in the LMICs, expertise from HICs, high income countries, could be used to set this up in low income countries. Now, the other area where we see benefit of this cross-collaboration between the six WHO regions is exchange programs. Now, these can be offered by hospitals. These can be offered by professional societies. For example, the exchange program between Society of Surgical Oncology and Indian Association of Surgical Oncology. the exchange programs that European Society of Surgical Oncology and many of these societies offer. And finally, through these societies, we can also help with trainees and faculty visit other parts of the world where they can gain expertise and bring them back home so that that can be contextualized to their specific resource settings.
I agree. You make a great case for collaboration. So the commission ends with an 8-point action plan and the initiatives that can be embarked upon to make progress in the 9 domains. Along with the actions, the commission provides a process for implementing the actions using core principles of implementation science and a determinant framework based on the consolidated framework for implementation research. The commission also provides an action index that can be used to measure success. So who is responsible for taking on these initiatives, and how should nations and regions measure progress?
Now, that's a good question. And before we go to who and how, I want to give the background to why we use this framework. As we know, the best of the best ideas die during implementation. And that's why implementation science is arising, or it's actually a risen field of research and so on, more so in healthcare. So when we started this commission, one thing we were very particular is that we were going to use the implementation science frameworks, and we used the consolidated framework for implementation research, which was initially developed by Dam Schroeder in 2019 and updated in 2022. So the CFIR framework was developed specifically for implementing solutions in healthcare, with the hope that it will increase the success in implementation of these solutions. The CFIR has 5 stages or 5 points. Number 1 is the actual action item or the solution. Number 2 is the process. Number 3 is the people that are involved. And then the inner and outer factors. So you see there are people that are involved in this. And in addition, we also added 2 other items. One is the barriers and time taken for implementation. So people is one of the 5 important components of this implementation science framework. So the people responsible for taking up these actions and initiatives and at the same time measuring progress should be everyone that's involved in the cancer surgical care pathway. So as I mentioned, there are people that are involved that control the inner and outer factors. So it should be surgeons that should be measuring outcomes in the trenches as they provide direct face-to-face patient care. Then it should be hospital administrators, which are one layer away from the operating room or the clinics, that look to see how they are supporting cancer surgery. And then you look at the public health and elected officials that provide support to the broader environment that is essential to sustaining cancer surgical care. And how do you measure success? To measure success, we developed an action index that has 5 action units. And, you know, we consulted with some experts in scale development, because when you do this, you want each item of the scale to be in continuum but mutually exclusive. So the 5 units go from needs development to demonstrating progress to meets expectations, then exceeds expectations, and then setting standards. The one thing we tried not to do is to come up with one size fits all, because we know, we just spoke previously about how things are so different across different parts of the world. So we try not to go on that foolhardy task of developing one scale that will, or one tool that can be used to measure progress. Instead, what we recommended is that people that are involved in measuring progress use tools that have already been established by global bodies such as WHO. You know, you can use the surgical safety checklist or their own countries. For example, in Malaysia, you have clinical practice guidelines for breast cancer. In Brazil, there's a 60-day law that states that cancer care should start within 60 days from diagnosis. So to summarize, everyone that's involved in the cancer surgical care pathway should be involved. And you can measure progress by using the action index units, but the tools to use to measure progress should be unique to each country or region of the world.
So ultimately, all of these actions, and especially things like capacity building, will need investment. So what are your thoughts on how funding might be secured for these initiatives?
You know, money talks, so that's the most important point. So to improve cancer surgery, we need investments. Unless we invest, we're not going to see an improvement. As they say, your output is directly proportional to the input. Now, as I mentioned before, cancer surgical services tend to be associated with high upfront costs, which is what most people that need to work on making the bottom lines look rosy gives them a bit of pause in investing in cancer surgical services. But when you sit down with them and tell them, when you amortize these over the years, and then you explain to them the horizontal benefit. So if you open a new set of operating rooms for providing effective cancer surgery, that will help trauma surgery, orthopedics, ENT, maternal and child health care. And then the other thing to keep in mind is cancer surgery is one of the key pillars in the cancer care pathway, but it tends to be one of the more durable ones. So if you take all of these and you explain to these people, yes, your upfront investments could be quite high, but these will be more than balanced out by the long-term benefits. And that's when people that control the purse strings can be convinced to invest in cancer surgery. Now, when you talk about investments, you just don't want to go to them and ask them, well, I need this new robot. No, you want to talk to them about investing in the entire cancer care pathway, of which surgery is one key pillar, ranging from increasing awareness, building infrastructure, building operating rooms with uninterrupted power and water supply, power supply, procuring surgical tools. That's only one part of it. Scaling up the surgical and non-surgical ancillary workforce, and then reducing out-of-pocket expenses. So, while we know we need more investment, you know, it's hard to control the world, but some of the steps to do that. The first one would be, is to lobby and advocate for increasing healthcare expenditure in the national budgets. So if you look at many countries, the amount of GDP that's allocated to healthcare is in the low single digits. And that's not going to shift the needle. The other thing to keep in mind is even if they increase the allocations towards healthcare, we should lobby for making sure that there's some part of it that's focused specifically towards upscaling surgical capacity, workforce systems and services. Then after that, what we should do is we should lobby for increasing the total public health expenditure. So there's, for every country, there's THE, that's called total health expenditure, that includes a combination of public and private. So our goal would be in that THE, you increase the public health expenditure component of it. That means it's taken care of by government and reduce out-of-pocket expenses. And then lastly, individual hospital systems. You know, in most parts of the world, systems are merging and healthcare systems are becoming so large. We'll talk more about this in the well-being section. So individual hospital systems, they're multi-billion dollar enterprises. So we should convince them to invest as well in healthcare. And about technology, you're right. Technology does play a role because every technology that's new, that's expensive now, will at some stage become affordable and effective. And as I mentioned before, the charm is finding the right time for introduction and that the right time on the inflection point of adoption of new technologies. And in this area as well, not only hospitals, but even governments can negotiate with the industry to get the optimal pricing for not only introducing the new technology, but creating a workforce that's adept at using it, then measuring outcomes and so on. So, you know, while there are many things that we need to do, you need investments in everything, the workforce, the education, the certification, the continuous professional development. It goes beyond just asking for one extra robot.
So let's take one more deep dive into two actions, which I think have particular relevance today. So the first is Action 7, which is promoting well-being among surgeons and the cancer care workforce. And second, Action 8, which is creating cancer surgical care delivery platforms that are resilient to ensure safe and timely cancer surgery during global catastrophic events such as pandemics, wars, and natural disasters. So first, well-being. Why did you decide to include this concept, and how does success in this area affect all domains of cancer surgical care?
Yeah, so this is a very important part of my day-to-day job as an associate dean, because in my office, we oversee 720 physician trainees. And, you know, without going into much detail, I trained at a time where this was nowhere to be thought, heard, or spoken of. Now it's almost the central core or plank of what we do. The reason being, it is well known that the rate of suicide among physicians is much higher than the general public. The rate of burnout, the rate of suicide, the rate of depression is much higher than the general public. There are many reasons for that. One of them I alluded to before earlier. As we become more and more technologically adept, you know, I always tell something to my trainees, you know, patients want you to hold their hand, not your mouse. But with technology coming up, that's what we do. An average physician, we spend so much of our time typing on the electronic medical record. So it's becoming more and more impersonal. And then there are some studies that have shown that an average trainee spends less than 13% of their week with face-to-face patient care. The remaining 67% is spent on administrative tasks, of which electronic medical record is one of them. We're not saying they're not beneficial. They are beneficial. We want electronic medical record because, you know, sometimes I can't even read my own writing. So electronic medical record is very valuable, but we need to also keep in mind what it does not do well. And as a result of all of this, what happens is physicians come into medicine so that they can spend time with patients or educate themselves. In my day, that's what we did 80% of the time, but now that's not what's going on. So you want to spend more time with your patient building relationships. Maybe you can still do that, but there are other competing factors for your time. And then the other thing is, you know, healthcare is a business. There's mergers, acquisitions happening. And what happens these days is that most physicians feel that a large part of their professional life is controlled by people near and distant that have no idea what they go through on a day-to-day basis. The best thing I say is, you know, I grew up at a time in India in the 70s and 80s. Sometimes the only treatment my father could provide to patients was compassion. But contrast that, now I work in places where we have these gleaming buildings with 4K technology where we offer patients everything but compassion. And that does play on physicians, you know, because the best thing that we can do in our profession is build relationships. Then you have the second victim syndrome. Physicians and healthcare professionals don't do well with failure. In the sense, if they lose a patient, which we do see that, but having said that, no matter how many times we go through, if we lose a patient for unavoidable reasons, it's still considered a failure and physicians get affected and it affects their well-being. And then, you know, if you talk about benign conditions, yeah, appendicitis is bad, but cancer is different. You have the disease and you have the diagnosis. And all of those make it very difficult. And not to forget, these things all got exacerbated in the last 3 to 4 years because of the pandemic. Now, why is this important? It's very important because if the healer is not healthy, they can't heal well. It's the same thing they tell on the flights, put on your mask first before you put it on for your children. So we've realized that if the healers are not healthy, it doesn't translate to good outcomes. So that's why I was very particular in including this section on well-being, and there's a whole section on solutions for that. And I think this is something we shouldn't be reactive about. We need to be proactive about. And when we do that, then we're not only improving the health of the workforce, but we're improving the outcomes for the patients.
Thank you for your passionate answer on that. So the second action that I wanted to dive into a little more deeply was cancer surgery in conflict and emergency situations, which includes pandemics. So what needs to be done to ensure cancer surgery as a part of the continuum of care can continue through these catastrophic events? And also, How can cancer surgery contribute to securing timely cancer care for those who are caught up in these events?
Yeah, this can be a more apt question because, you know, this commission started work 3 or 4 months before the pandemic. So we got affected too. And we were just an academic publication. Imagine cancer patients waiting for surgery. So, you know, this should have been obvious to us, but you really can't blame anyone because the last time we had such a major global disruption of such catastrophic scale was around World War I or II. And, you know, there aren't that many people alive from them to impart their wisdom, nor even if the handful of them are there, those lessons may not apply to the present day. So not being prepared for this, we witnessed several disruptions along the entire cancer care pathway, starting from screening to surgical procedures. You know, in the beginning, it was fine. We said, you know, go get more systemic therapy, then we'll schedule your surgery. But you can only get so much systemic therapy because systemic therapy is not free lunch either. But we're starting to see the after effects of those disruption. You know, lack of screening when there was a severe drop in the rate of screening, 20, 40, 50% in some of the cancers, wasting patients in more advanced stages of disease. I call that COVID stage migration, where you had an upstaging of the disease due to a delay in diagnosis. And then as a result of that, we're operating on patients with more advanced stages of disease. So the short-term and long-term oncologic outcomes have been compromised because of that. So to prevent something like this, we added an action item in that, and I'll just outline a few of those. The first one is, when the pandemic was unraveling or exploding, it was felt by many, well, cancer surgical procedures are elective procedures. So, you know, let's cancel them. Let's put them away. We need to focus on trauma, maternal health care, which is true. But I think what needs to change is just because it's an elective procedure and you don't see the bad outcome in the immediate short term, you can postpone it. So first thing is cancer surgery should be elevated to the same level. Then the next one is, this is quite intuitive, but we did not do it. We need to have an adequate supply, not just of surgical equipment and PPE, but systemic therapy too. Like, what if we have to tell them, go get more systemic therapy and you don't have enough of that? And then the third one that we all feel strongly about is hospitals should have designated operating rooms, and some did that, or designated wards that can be used for all purposes in normal times, but during catastrophic times, there should be some flip switch mechanism, such as, say, if 25% of your elective cancer surgical procedures are getting canceled, then these ORs will become designated exclusively for cancer surgery. So those are some of the things that we put forth. Now, one group of people that you really feel bad about is people that are displaced or refugees as a result of wars and conflicts. Now, God bless them. They suffer from multiple insults. To begin with, they have the diagnosis of cancer. Then they migrate not knowing where they're going to end up, coming into a whole different health system. It's bad enough you have cancer, then you have the anxiety of not speaking the language. And it's highly unlikely when you're evacuating on an emergent basis, you're going to think of your medical records. So you'll land up in a place where you can't explain what you have, nor the people there, despite their good intentions, can understand what you have. So I think that's a tragic situation. It's sad to see what's going on in the world, but I was very particular we included one of these that so that we can be proactive about it and not reactive like we were when the pandemic started.
Thank you. So finally, one major theme of the commission is the responsibility of cancer surgeons themselves in elevating and promoting the essential role of cancer surgery on the local, regional, and global stage. So what are the most vital steps cancer surgeons and other people in positions of power can take to ensure the ambitions of this commission, which is access to safe, timely, and affordable cancer surgery for everyone, are achieved?
Yeah, so we have something in the surgical world that we say, cancer surgery leadership on the national and global stage is conspicuous not by its presence, but by its absence. So, for example, when the current president, Mr. Biden, during his vice president, the waning days of his vice presidency, convened the Moonshot Program. I don't think there was any surgical oncologist there. From what we were told, and I can't verify the accuracy, there may have been one surgeon, but I don't think there was any surgical oncologist there. Now, at the same time, cancer care is multidisciplinary. Every other entity in the cancer care pathway is much better represented at local, regional, national, and global levels. Now, not sure what the reasons are, but you don't find many cancer surgeons in any of these leadership positions, although it's changing a little slowly. Now, you don't have cancer surgeons in these positions to influence change. What do you expect? Cancer surgery does not get the same level of importance in these avenues. Now, I want to state something very clearly. We're not talking about a zero-sum game to say it's either cancer surgery or systemic or radiotherapy. No, all of these are important. It's not cancer surgery versus them. It's cancer surgery and all of them. So until now, we feel that there hasn't been enough emphasis placed on them. But I think if we place enough emphasis on every pillar in the cancer care pathway, that's when you'll see an improvement in outcomes. Now, to make that happen, cancer surgeons need to do some things which they may not be familiar with or uncomfortable with. And first of them is they need to assume leadership positions out of the traditional surgical arenas. Like most cancer surgeons want to be leaders in the positions that relate to the immediate operating environment and so on. But you need to get out of that and which can be a little difficult because most cancer surgeons spend years honing their operative skills, not leadership skills. But that's also changing slowly. Then cancer surgeons should also be involved in advocacy for the importance of surgery, which we don't do that well. And they can do this by lobbying public health officials or elected officials and kind of imparting to them the wisdom of the value of cancer surgery. And again, this will be something new for cancer surgeons. You know, most of us think, well, I need to be in the OR or taking care of someone, but you do need a handful of surgeons that can be out there lobbying for the broader support and the broader socio-political and economic context of the cancer care pathway. Now, there's an old saying that says, if you're not at the table, you run the risk of being on the menu. And cancer surgeons have not been at the table for a long time, but as I said, we're seeing some rays of hope and a glimmer of light. You know, these two Lancet Oncology Commissions are a testament to that. And I think as more and more cancer surgeons get involved in leadership roles beyond the traditional surgical arena, we can highlight the value of cancer surgery, which eventually, as a part of the multidisciplinary care construct, will only translate to better outcomes for patients.
Well, thank you, Chandra. It's been a privilege speaking with you today. I want to thank you for taking the time to discuss your commission with me today. We encourage you to read the commission and accompanying comments and peruse the infographic at thelancet.com. Thank you to Dr. Are, and thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the Lancet Oncology podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts.